You're listening to a dayone.fm show.
I think that AI is going to be very, very important. It already, of course, is important. And I think in the spectrum of possible outcomes, on the one hand, you have the scaling curves don't bend. We have half an order of magnitude of improvement every single year. And you know, AI becomes the most important invention since fire. It's like humanity defining. So that's like one possible outcome. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we have diminishing returns and it becomes merely the most important invention since the internet, right? It's like a career defining moment in time. And for me, I felt just a crazy FOMO about the idea of not having front row seats to seeing that play out. So those are the main two reasons that I think motivated us. And thankfully, my co-founder and my team were also very excited about moving over. So we made the move.
Welcome back to Diaspora.nz, where we're on a mission to seek out and profile the hidden gems, the best founders, operators, researchers, and emerging leaders of the great Kiwi expat community. Today, we're chatting with Min Kyu Zhang. He's the CEO and co-founder of Ivo, an AI assistant for legal teams. He founded Ivo after joining a large corporate law firm in New Zealand and seeing just so many low-hanging fruit, under-optimized processes around him. He taught himself how to code in 2 months and took the leap. He's since moved his whole team to San Francisco, and he thinks other founders should follow suit. According to Min Kyu, there is an inflection point in the human experience underway, and if you want to be building an AI, you need to be at the front lines. He's not afraid to roll up his sleeves and do the work to sell, to get connected with the right people, even if that means a lot of cold outbound. He talks about how it helped him land a tech co-founder, hundreds of customer conversations, an angel investment from Daniel Gross, and over $6 million to date from top funds like Uncork Capital and Fika. This is a great episode, really enjoyed recording, so let's go get stuck in. Min Kyu, it is fantastic to have you on the Diaspora.nz podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I have been fascinated to track you down. I'm glad to be doing this live in San Francisco because you've found yourself living here in San Francisco. And that's going to be one of the main things that we get to talk about, because I know it's something that you've felt quite passionate about and in a sense of helping to build the company and build the future you want to live in. Give us the high level. Give us the teaser. Who are you today? Why are we having this conversation?
Fantastic. Yeah, I'm Min Kyu. I'm the CEO and co-founder at Ivo. We are building an AI legal assistant for legal teams. We help with contract review. So contract review, very specifically, we think is the most important part of the contracting lifecycle. So that's what we help with. And I used to be a corporate lawyer, which is why this particular problem is something that's very important to me.
But you've been humble. You've done a lot and also had a lot of progress recently, raised some money.
Yeah, so we've raised $6.2 million in total so far. Like very early days for us, of course, but we've had great traction over the last year or so.
Yeah, and I think uniquely from the NZ background, got some fantastic investors from the US market as well. Take us back. I would love to, sort of in the different parts of this podcast, I want to start with what made you? How did you get to where you are today?
So when I was a university student, I started a tutoring company with a few of my friends. And I think, I heard you describe tutoring companies as like a gateway business. Definitely, I think that's what it was for me. It was a ton of fun. And I think the main thing I realized was you don't need permission from anyone to kind of sell something that people want. You don't need to interview with anyone to get commission in the same way you would with a regular job. You can just build something or sell something and people will pay you money for it if they like the service. So that was a great moment for me because that empowered me with I realized I had a lot of agency in my life. I could just go out and do something like that.
And this is an experience that took you through until university to have taught me about high school, about you're born and brought up in Auckland?
Hamilton in Auckland, a little bit in Auckland as well. I was born in Korea.
So born in Korea, raised Hamilton, Auckland. Tell me about the family environment. When you think about inflection points earlier in your life, what are the paths that even inspired you to go into law and to studying in the field you did in the first place?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think probably two things. The first is that I think some degree of it was it felt like the default choice. I don't think I was super intentional about going to law. And I think it's super common for Kiwis and Australians. I've noticed as well, because you studied law as well.
I studied law and I'd do it again today. I certainly haven't been a lawyer. Yeah. You lasted about a year and a half in law, I believe.
Yeah, just under 2 years or so. But I guess the first thing is, I think the default path for a lot of ambitious young Kiwis and Australians who don't really know what they want to do is studying law, because you can do it as an undergrad degree, of course. Yeah, and that was one component of it. And the other one was, I always thought there was something very noble about the legal profession and something very romantic about the idea of practicing law. And I think some component of that contributed to my decision.
In the wisdom of hindsight, I'm sure I wasn't thinking this at the time, but I now see studying law as understanding the code that runs the reality, the physical world.
Yeah.
In the same way that studying computer science helps you understand the code that runs the software or the digital world. And I think there's something in there in hindsight where if you want to make it in the world, you've got to understand the rules in order to know what to push and what to bend. The journey from law school, I mean, so keep us in that moment. What was the tutoring business? Yeah, it's obviously a personal pain point or an opportunity that you were sort of leaning into.
Yeah, and just going back to your comment just now, that's really interesting because when I first taught myself how to code, like one of the first things I realized is there's so many analogies between contracts and computer programs. It was like really interesting down to the way lawyers like to define terms and contracts. It's very similar to declaring a variable. Even like the kind of logic you use in a contract is very similar to the way a computer program will boil down to a kind of Boolean true or false value. So that's kind of a really interesting observation that I've thought a lot about. I guess to go back to your question about the tutoring business, one of the only jobs I could get as a university student was being a tutor. I used to be an English tutor for high school students. And I kind of had this like realization that a lot of tutoring companies were charging double the amount of money that I was charging. And I couldn't like understand what they were doing that I couldn't do. So I had this realization that perhaps I should start my own tutoring business.
And you did, you built the agency, you obviously got yourself through, graduated, I think went to Bill Gully in Auckland, was the first sort of hop into the professional ladder. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
And I heard you described as a tortured lawyer who had a sort of a nagging problem in your time in the law. There must have been a moment in that first couple of years where you're exposed to AI and what's happening. Take me into that moment.
Yeah, well, maybe you've felt this as well, but in the first few months I started practicing, it was immediately obvious to me that there was so much low-hanging fruit in the legal profession, so many under-optimized processes. And I was kind of that guy having water cooler conversations with all of my colleagues, like, oh, why doesn't someone just build something to fix this like particular problem or this other particular problem? And like my mind was like overflowing with all of these ideas for how we could make things better. And I think eventually like that compulsion to do something about it became so strong, I ended up leaving. But originally our product didn't have any AI in it. So the first version of the first product that I built wasn't an AI product. And kind of the reason for that was I felt like there was so much low hanging fruit that almost there was so many things we could tackle.
Tell me about the first version of the product. So you had the conviction to go and build something. Did you build that while you're still working or did you sort of quit your job?
No, I left my career first because I had to teach myself how to code first, which was like a 2-month process.
So you taught yourself to code in 2 months, which is notable on its own.
Not very well. I was a terrible programmer. So I'm very lucky to have actual, you know, great programmers working with us now. But it was enough to build the first version of the initial product, which was completely different to what we're doing now. The idea was we would be able to help non-lawyers like create contracts more efficiently and then sign them and manage them afterwards. And we were initially targeting like very small early stage startups.
Knowing what you now know, what would you go back and tell yourself or tell another tortured lawyer or banker or doctor sitting there, you know, feeling the same about like the low-hanging fruit in their industry who wants to learn to code? What would you encourage yourself to do to do it faster, do it better?
That's a great question. I think finding a great technical co-founder is probably better than what I did. I think the way I did it was probably a lot more difficult than it had to be. I think in retrospect, I underestimated how difficult it was to like build great software products. And it's not very easy to do if you're starting from zero like I was. Part of the problem I had was I just didn't know many software engineers who would be willing to do something like this with me. I went to this big effort of trying to network and going to these events and finding like some coding genius to build this product. That didn't work out. But if you do have the opportunity to find like a great co-founder, which I did eventually.
Yeah, I would gently push back on that because I think that what the path that you took is one that I have a lot of respect for. And in fact, after a career of working with great engineers, I found the best way to get a great engineer to work with you is actually just to make a well-intentioned effort to build something. They'll respect the effort, they'll respect the progress to get the early signs of traction that you obviously managed to get to show that there is a problem here worth solving that then they'll be more likely to opt in or want to come in and help you out with. Yeah, so eventually found the co-founder. How far along was that and what was the process like when you ultimately recruited and built the team?
Yeah, that was probably, I don't know, a year or a year and a half after I started building the company or after I left my career. Yeah, that was interesting. So at that point, I'd raised a small angel round, 400,000 USD. So I had like enough money to pay myself a salary and enough money to hire somebody else as well. So I didn't know anyone. I worked all of my networks. And then what I ended up doing was just emailing all the people cold. So I found a list of people who I thought were really interesting. I sent them a bunch of emails and I kept sending them emails until they agreed to meet with me. And eventually that was how I found my co-founder.
Wow.
There was kind of a learning process I had to go through, which was it is okay to just send cold emails and cold DMs or whatever. I think most Kiwis have this cultural aversion to reaching out and imposing themselves on other people. And I think as a founder, that's the first thing you need to get good at.
Tell us about that $400,000 round coming together. One of the first chicken and egg problems people often face is just getting the capital to get off the sidelines and just get started. How did you go about putting together that original angel round? You mentioned some of that coming from the US as well.
Yeah. So my case was very unusual and probably not generalizable to other people. But in my case, I wasn't actively trying to raise a round, which was kind of interesting. So I DM'd this guy called Daniel Gross in the US. And I said, hey, check out this thing that I'm building. We ended up meeting and he really liked what I was doing. And he said, hey, do you want some money? And then I said, yes, I would. And then that's how the round came together. So my case is very serendipitous. You know, I was lucky I didn't have to go through an intentional process of trying to put a round together. Of course, I did have to do that for later rounds of funding.
I mean, there's serendipitous and then there's taking actions. You know, you've put yourself in the path of luck. And again, it's sort of a similar thread through into the recruiting the co-founder. It's just a willingness to do the outbound and do the work to engage with people where otherwise others might not have done that. And part of that, I was reading about your move to San Francisco and coming over here, and you felt like at the time you came in, you might not have had much of a network. Tell us about the decision to uplift your life and family and shift over and the why behind that.
The way it started was one of our investors, this was Daniel, suggested I move over just for 3 months and see what it's like in San Francisco. So I moved over. At the time, we had 3 or 4 people. So we were all living in an Airbnb together. All of us were Kiwis. And it was a lot of fun. And we decided to make the move permanent. And there were like two realizations that I had. And the first one was that we were much more likely to be successful if we moved the company to San Francisco. I think that's probably true for the vast majority of Kiwi founders. When I talk to my Kiwi friends, I always say to them, you should seriously consider moving over here. Like, it might be the case that you have special circumstances that make it so you don't apply and you're a unique case, but you should at least be like very suspicious of whether you're being driven by inertia bias versus like making the best decision to make your company succeed. And the prior probability of your hometown happening to be the best place in the world to start your company is like extremely unlikely, right? So then the next question is like, what is the best place to start your company? And across almost every single metric you can imagine, the San Francisco Bay Area seems to win out for most types of companies. So that was the first thing. And then the second thing was, I think that AI is going to be very, very important. It already, of course, is important. And I think in the spectrum of possible outcomes, on the one hand, you have the scaling curves don't bend. We have half an order of magnitude of improvement every single year. And you know, AI becomes the most important invention since fire. It's like humanity defining. So that's like one possible outcome. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we hit diminishing returns and it becomes merely the most important invention since the internet, right? It's like a career defining moment in time. And for me, I felt just crazy FOMO about the idea of not having front row seats to seeing that play out. So those are the main two reasons that I think motivated us. And thankfully, my co-founder and my team were also very excited about moving over. So we made the move.
I agree with you. I also want to like take the time to debunk some of the common critiques of it, because there are some counter arguments, counter positions to the move over. Like, you know, some people would say, well, the talent's more expensive. You know, you come here, even if you bring your team over, you're going to have to pay them market rates in order to keep them or keep them loyal. Another might say that, well, you hire people here, but they're more mercenary. They're more likely to jump ship after a year or two to the next thing. Whereas if you have people in New Zealand, they're going to be loyal for the long term. You might have people who can say, I can get 80-20 of the value by flying in regularly or by doing something. And I'm just really curious to push on this because, I do agree with you that there is something in the culture that you can absorb as a founder. Can you put a finger on it, perhaps, you know, refuting those points, the talent, the mercenary, the culture, where does it come from?
I think those first 2 points are like true, right? You know, I wouldn't claim that starting a company in San Francisco is better than starting a company in New Zealand across like literally every single dimension. There are some dimensions where there are advantages in New Zealand as well. And of course, it's very possible to start a great company in New Zealand. We know that because there are great companies that have been founded in New Zealand. But I think like the way to think about it is, starting a startup, the odds of creating $1 billion plus outcome are very slim. Most startups fail, and the place that seems to produce more billion-dollar plus companies than anywhere else in the world is probably the best place to do that. Mm. And there are all sorts of reasons for that. Like you mentioned like ambition. I think ambition is super malleable, and the founders here are so much more ambitious than anywhere else in the world.
I saw a quote actually from you as the standards of achievement in the SF Bay Area are just unquestionably higher. And I'm just curious in what ways, in the sense of the peers that you compare yourself with on a day-to-day basis, are that much more ambitious. I'm curious, do you have tangible examples of people you've met or people you've seen where you've said, oh shit, I can aim higher?
Yeah.
Like, who raised your ambitions?
Well, you know, I think generally people here are just so unapologetic about, you know, I'm going to change the world and create this incredible large company. I think in New Zealand, it's a little bit embarrassing to say that, right? Whereas here, people are super unapologetic about it. I don't know. When I think of specific examples, I remember the first week I moved over here, I went to a dinner with a bunch of founders, and I was sitting across from this woman, and she was an early stage founder, and she was telling me she just started this company. And I was like, oh, so how's the company doing? And she said that they made it to 5 million in ARR in 6 months. And she said this occasionally. And if she was a Kiwi, everyone would know who she was. She'd be on the front page of every newspaper. But I think in the Bay Area, it was just so unremarkable that a founder could do that. I think when you just keep seeing things like that happen to people who are like no more brilliant than you are, you know, you can't help but think, maybe, you know, I should be putting my standards should be higher. I should be trying to do that as well. So I think there's a component of that that's missing back at home.
There's a reference that I've kept with me for years now. It originally came from an Alex Danko blog. It's the social capital structure of Silicon Valley. And this concept's the golden rule of Silicon Valley. You know, out in the rest of the world, you generally treat people like you'd like to be treated. You're courteous and kind, and that's about it. In Silicon Valley, you treat people like they might be the next breakout founder. Because if they are, you want them to remember you, maybe let you invest in their round, maybe hire you, maybe, you know, reference you in the future. And I think it's that culture of even the 18-year-old you meet in the street might be the next Dylan Field. The individuals, it's sort of the malleability of the social hierarchy here is incredible. We've got this far, we haven't even really started talking about the product. You gave us a bit of an introduction to Ivo in the start of this. I'd love to go a couple of layers deeper, understand the sort of the strategy you've taken as to building out and understanding the lawyers you're working with. One question that comes to mind immediately is, in the law, it's very important to be accurate, and AI models are not known for their accuracy as hallucinations. The kinds of problems you're solving were not really previously solvable with software. Now that LLMs allow legal teams to outsource their judgment to software, it's possible, but it still requires that confidence and accuracy. How do you solve the hallucination problem in the short term, and how do you see that over time?
You know, I think, first of all, large language models are obviously not 100% accurate. And it's interesting because contracts are a domain where you need 100% accuracy. And I think the mistake a lot of AI products make, particularly like those AI demos that you see that are really interesting and look amazing, and then it turns out that they don't have enduring usage. I think the main mistake is they don't build the products with the failure cases in mind. So I think users are comfortable or happy to tolerate inaccuracy as long as there's really good legibility into the relationships between like the inputs and the outputs, and users understand if the output is inaccurate, they understand why it's inaccurate. Mm. And the product like handles the case where it's inaccurate as well. So it's a little bit counterintuitive, but what we've done with our product is we've added like extra clicks that the user has to make, right? So usually you want to minimize the number of clicks. And in our case, we deliberately added extra clicks the user has to make because we want the user to really precisely control, like, here are the inputs that they're making, and then we want them to understand, here is why the AI generated the output in the way that they did.
So if I could play that back to you, instead of trying to guarantee that the model will always, or the output will always be 100% accurate, you are instead drawing the user's attention to the output in a way that they have to verify it and check it. But a lot of the work has been done for them.
Yeah.
And it's sort of about building that user experience. I mean, you wrote about LLM user experiences and how the user experience needs to be either completely seamless and lightning fast, or it needs to provide the legibility into the machinery that creates the output. So in your case, Ivo is sort of in that second bucket. Break that comparison down for us. There's a fascinating blog.
So I think the first option for a great UX is something like GitHub Copilot, right? And the thing that GitHub Copilot did really well was they kind of recognized that there was a trade-off between like speed and accuracy. But actually, you know, you want to have more speed in that particular case, because if a user has to wait for an inaccurate output, they're going to be really annoyed. Whereas if you're just suggesting and suggestions are being generated really quickly, you can dismiss them more easily as well. The other way to handle it is you don't make it super fast, but you set it up so that even if the output is bad, there's still like some utility that we're able to provide for you. And then also we help you make a judgment call as to whether or not the output is accurate or not. The way I think about it is a first year associate is not 100% accurate, right? Like I know first year lawyer is going to be trusted enough to take some important contract and give it to a client or a third party without having a senior person look over that agreement. You know, you can still become a lot more efficient if you have that junior lawyer helping you. So that's the way we think about it. Of course, the great thing about a junior lawyer is if you spend enough time working with one, you understand the failure modes and you can ask them questions to figure out why they decided to redline an agreement the way that they did. I think that's what's missing from a lot of AI products. They don't have the equivalent of that process of kind of figuring out why the outputs are bad.
And so over time, as the models improve, as the product experience improves, does that turn from being a first-year lawyer into a second-year associate into being a third-year, more experienced lawyer? And I'm really curious about the second or third degree impact of that path. And one of the critiques of AI's impact onto the workforce would be good lawyers became good lawyers by first being junior lawyers and being mentored and shaped by their seniors. And if your product is ultimately successful, is there a smaller on-ramp for new junior lawyers to learn the skills, learn the profession?
Yeah, so I'll answer those questions in order. So the first question was, you're asking about how do we extrapolate out the progress of LLMs and does that mean that we end up with smarter and smarter lawyers? Yes, that's true. And the kind of really interesting thing about the industry we're in is that the pace of progress is so fast that every 3 years we have this innovator's dilemma situation where like completely new UXs are possible and that they're like completely different product assumptions we have to build on. Our product, for example, wasn't possible until GPT-4 was available. Like when we first started thinking about the product, GPT-4 wasn't available. It was GPT-3, 3.5. And we knew that the product wasn't possible at that point, but we could extrapolate out that the models would improve in certain predictable ways, right? The ability to reason through contracts would improve. We knew that like context windows would expand. And like based on that knowledge, we were able to predict this is what a product could look like once these models become better. And I think founders kind of have to do the same thing now when they anticipate when the next generation of these models become available. Everything I just said before about having to have a lower level user experience might not apply anymore, right? Like you might be able to have more sophisticated workflows where you have multiple chain queries together, which kind of isn't possible now because we don't have enough. If you have one more line of reliability, you can do a lot more very interesting things.
Let's ground this for my and everyone's sake. Give us like two examples in a tangible reality of how a senior lawyer would use Ivo as a sort of quasi junior lawyer today, reviewing a contract, case study, if you may, and then how might that be different with GPT-5 or beyond?
Yeah. So at the moment, when you review an agreement with Ivo, you open up your document. We have this review feature. We review your agreements against your requirements, but we go through each of your requirements one by one. And then we generate kind of suggestions for how you can resolve those discrepancies. And then the other thing we do is we look at your standard clause language from your precedents, and we generate compromise language between your clause and the counterparty's clause.
Compromise language meaning that, you know, if we're going to meet a middle ground on it in an actual business term, in a business sense, you're not just commenting on the legal language used, you're commenting on the arrangement that the legal language describes.
Yeah, so we want to keep the counterparty's language as much as possible, but we want to insert some of the issues we think might be important to you based on your provision. Now, the really easy way to build this feature would have just been to, you click a button and we generate this compromise clause. Instead, the way we built it is we have this intermediate step where instead of generating the provision, we generate a list of suggestions. And we say, these are all of the ways your provision is different from the counterparty's provision. And here are suggestions for how you can resolve the discrepancy. And then the user goes through and decides which of those suggestions they want to accept and incorporate as part of the compromise provision. I mean, the benefit of doing that is that the user really closely understands like why the output is being generated in the way it does, because they had to go through and select each option for themselves, right? So that kind of makes sense right now. It might be that when GPT-5 is available, there's no need to have that intermediate step. You might as well go straight to the point where we generate the output, because the output will be so powerful, and having to like click through these checklist items is kind of like a suboptimal UX if the models are powerful enough.
Which kind of goes back to the question about the learning curve for the lawyer, because even at the moment, you know, the lawyer is still going to be expressing some of their own judgment. So they've got to develop their judgment in order to be able to choose between the clauses that have been presented. And you're saying in 2 or 5 or who knows, 6 months time, that might not be the case.
Yeah, that's right. I was going to say your second question before was about training for junior lawyers. And I don't know, I don't have a super strong opinion on this, but when I think back to when I was a junior lawyer, a lot of the work that I did kind of under the justification of training, I felt like probably could have been done by a robot. You know, I'm talking about things like reviewing agreements for consistent defined terms, proofreading agreements, making sure that the clause references were all up to date. These are the sort of changes, or this is the sort of workload that in practice that junior lawyers spend a lot of time doing. frankly, they shouldn't have to spend their time doing stuff like that. So I don't know. I'm optimistic that like, the quality of the training will increase even as some of these low-hanging fruit tasks get automated away.
Totally makes sense. As you think about progressive models and unlocking progressive power that you'll be able to incorporate in your product, there's also a risk that the progressive models are going to reduce the defensibility that you have baked into your model today. Now, in some industries and some vertical AI applications, you could build a defensible advantage based on your proprietary user training data or proprietary workflows or various things. I'm curious in your case, because a lot of the client data will be very sensitive. You won't be able to train on one client's data for another. More broadly, how do you think about defensibility as the AI model underpinning your business gets stronger and stronger?
Yeah, I think there are like interesting ways you can do defensibility on a per customer basis, right? So you use your example, we can't use one of our customers' data to train a model for the benefit of another customer, but you can do things on a per user basis and increase personalization that I think is really interesting from a defensibility perspective. I also think defensibility is an interesting question. All SaaS companies have to figure out this question, and there are like ways to build defensibility that don't rely on the model itself, which is the way I think a lot of these vertical SaaS products will go. I think most vertical SaaS companies using AI seem to fail more because they fail to build a product that users are actually using and really creates value for users, which I think is a more realistic failure mode.
So at the core of it, all it really boils down to is an AI company, a SaaS company 2 or 3 years ago, they're all just figuring out the core customer pain point and figuring out some unique relationship with that customer.
Yeah, I think the questions you would ask to figure out like how defensible our company could become are like the same questions you'd ask like a company like Salesforce, right? Like, of course, we use AI, but we're both enterprise SaaS companies that need to build defensibility in many ways, not just on the model layer.
How do you think about knowing what you now know, validating ideas or getting into the game today? If there's a founder listening to this that's thinking about a vertical application of AI to whatever niche professional or industry or vertical they know well, what advice would you give to them? Other than move to San Francisco, of course.
Oh boy, yeah. I don't know if I have great advice other than, I guess, like we've spoken so far about like first, it's really important that how the product is built, you're really careful about the UX and thinking about how do you handle cases where the models aren't accurate or where the outputs aren't accurate, because that'll happen a lot of the time. So the corollary to point one is I think it's really important to build a product that people actually use and love. I think it's really easy to be tricked right now because so many companies have discretionary kind of AI budgets. Mm. So it's really easy to be tricked with some traction.
Okay, so double click on that. How did you get under the surface and build a company that your users really love? You in their offices, you looking over their shoulder. What is the product discovery, the pain point discovery process that you went through?
Yeah, look, at this point, I've spoken to like quite literally hundreds, maybe over 1,000 lawyers. I've spent a lot of time with them. And I think that's given me really good, hopefully really good instincts to what legal teams want and the kind of pain points that they face. So I think I have good intuition around the problems users have. I think there's been a lot of iteration. The first version of our product looks completely different to the version that we have now. So there's been this very continuous process of putting our product in front of our users, seeing what they think and getting that feedback back to us. Incidentally, one of the benefits of being in the US is all of our customers are in the US as well. So we can do things like literally go to the offices and stand over their shoulder watching them use our product.
Let's shift into the final part of the interview. There's one of my favorites. It's called, how can we help you? How do we bend the universe to support your goals? For example, are there any dream customers that you'd love to be introduced to or partners you'd love to be working with?
Great question. We are trying to sell to more Fortune 500 companies. So to the extent anyone can give us introductions or referrals.
And it's going to be legal teams, general counsels, compliance teams.
Yeah, legal operations.
What roles do you have open? If somebody wants to come work for Ivo, what are the roles and what's the kind of talent you want to hire? Pitch us. Imagine I'm a future recruit. Why should I join you?
So right now we are hiring for another account executive, which is a sales position. And that is actually the only position we're hiring for right now. Although, of course, I always like to meet great talent. It's always great to have a good pipeline talent because you never know when circumstances will line up. Why should you join us? We're growing incredibly fast. We are loved by our customers who are companies whose products you use every single day. And we have strong signs of product market fit. I also think this is a really exciting opportunity. The market we're in is clearly going to become incredibly large. It is very competitive, but I think we're in a good position to win this market. So you should definitely join.
You're obviously well-funded. What are the things that you want to grow into? Can you share? The next milestone will be a Series A. It'll be sometime a year from now, whenever it is. What are the things you want to achieve by that point?
The interesting thing about the market we're in, I think every time you see a new new platform shift that enables the creation of new categories, usually there's this limited time window before the market ossifies and you see this like sorting mechanism happen where you have the clear market leader and then you have two or three kind of competitors who do pretty well and then this long tail of companies who fade into irrelevance. So for us, I don't know if the next year is like the right time frame, but in the next certainly few years, we want to make sure that we are at the top once everything
is. So you're in land grab mode, you are accelerating and you want to keep accelerating.
Yeah.
And whatever it takes to hit those targets.
Great. Yeah.
Awesome. Anything else people should get in touch with you about? What could NZ be doing for you, if anything?
Good question. So I mentioned before, we aren't hiring a lot just right now. But if you are an amazing engineer or if you know an amazing engineer, you should talk to me because I always like meeting great engineers. And I do think a really key part of our success so far is we have great engineering talent. And I want to make sure that we continue to maintain that.
Awesome. And where can we find you online?
I'm not super active online. I have a LinkedIn if you want to connect with me, and I have a Twitter account. I can't remember what my name is.
That's okay. I'll look it up. I'll stick it in the show notes.
Yeah.
I love it. Thank you. Thank you for conversation. That was a lot of fun, and excited to follow along on the journey.
Thanks so much. Cheers.
That's a wrap. Thanks for listening. As a quick reminder, make sure you hit subscribe in your favorite podcast player so you can keep getting stories like this landing your feed every Friday, power you through those weekend chores. I want to give a quick shout out to the boys at Supermix who do all our editing. Zach and Xavier are Kiwi expats themselves. They're building a thriving business in the heart of New York City. A lot of respect. Not a sponsor, just a happy customer here. Also, for my day job, I'm an entrepreneur in residence and an investor at Blackbird Ventures. We're backing the best Kiwi founders wherever they are in the world. My personal sweet spot is pre-seed and seed. I like to say no check is too early, so drop me a line anytime. It's dbooth@blackbird.vc. We'll look forward to seeing you back next week.